You're listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast about music, place, and change. My name is Rebecca Bruton. What you'll hear today is my interview with Jonathan Kochuk, recorded in spring 2022. John is an Albertan composer, wilderness recordist, and paleontology enthusiast. He is fascinated by how the music and sound we create can interact with and stem from the natural world, rather than just mirror the sounds and structures we hear. Much like a documentary might aim to illustrate facts about a subject, his work aims to document, archive, and translate the emotional atmosphere of non-human natural environments. John's latest album, Everyone, came out on June 10th, 2022. Can you describe for me the first instant in your life when you recall feeling a connection to a more than human natural environment?
Wow. These are some, I gotta say, these are some bigly questions. To a more than human natural environment. Oh my God. I can't remember a time where that wasn't a thing. I mean, yes. The first time, I don't remember this, but it is a story. My first movie was an IMAX at a, where's the IMAX in Calgary? Market Mall or something? No,
Eau Claire.
Thank you. And there's a story of myself as a toddler breaking free of my parents' grasp and running up to the IMAX railing and trying to feed gorillas popcorn. And I think that's probably my first true attempt to commune with nature.
Certainly more than human, more than cyborg even.
Yeah. Possibly sapient, but certainly, yeah, that's probably the first time.
Bunch of questions lined up for you, but I want to start by asking, where are you today? Where are you located?
Yeah, I am located in Nelson, British Columbia, or so-called Nelson, British Columbia right now. And I'm never located anywhere very permanently. So this is cool, because this has actually kind of been a home for me for a while now. Yeah.
And can you describe a little bit about what you consider your practice to be these days?
My practice consists of doing emails until 10 p.m. and then not doing very much music, and I'm trying to change that. No, it's just, you know, in the cycle of being a composer, there's moments of like great administration, and then moments of focused writing. At least for me, I don't mix them very well. I kind of go on and off as my own administrator. So, I'm releasing a record right now, so we're very in admin mode. But I think my most consistent routine is the lack of routine. So my practice from how I composed that record called Everyone is very different than the practice that I have now, where I'm starting to work on my next record. And that's sort of by design. You know, I like to set up different, it's like Calvin ball, you know, like it has different rules every time. And that's stimulating to me.
So I know on the record that came out prior to Everyone, it's an album called North. And from what I understand is you created compositions for it. And then you went into remote wilderness spaces, played those pieces back into those spaces, and then re-recorded, capturing the natural or more than human acoustics of those spaces. So I have a bunch of curiosities about that, but maybe since we're discussing your upcoming record, how is your new way of working on this newest piece different or the same from what you did on North?
Yeah, North is funny because it's the first time I've ever, as soon as I wrote North, I was like, all right, I might not write music like that for the rest of my life, but I'm not embarrassed by this. And this is for sure my first real offering into the world as a composer. So I do still feel that way. I like that record, and I don't think I'll ever not like that record, but it is in some way, in so many ways, actually, the trial, the proof of concept for Everyone. It's like Everyone light. A lot of the practices in North around recording voice and collaging performances from people all over the world and trying to work remotely and bringing sound out into the forest and playing it back and re-recording it as it reverberates. They're very rooted, like those all existed in North, and that process was the process of making that record sort of allowed me to do Everyone, which was sort of the more evolved version of North, where instead of just going out into the forest with a single speaker and a few small little microphones, it was 7 speakers, 200 pounds of cabling, 15 microphones, Dolby Atmos, terabytes of vocal performance. It was just this monolithic version of North. I think North teed up Everyone in a lot of ways. Thank you.
So what would be an example of the process from start to finish of recording a single piece on Everyone?
It's quite literally an 8-year process to finish one piece. Everyone isn't necessarily... North was different in that it's arranged in chronological order. I would write one piece and I would finish it, and then I would write another piece and I would finish it. And there was like no cutting. It was just like, oh, I think North is 8 tracks or something. It's a pretty short record. I have 8 tracks done. No, there was no 9th that got thrown out. It was very much very lean in that way. Everyone sort of coalesced all at once. After 8 years, like, I couldn't tell you, it was very much a holistic piece. I have many, many, many hours of ideas and recordings that were condensed down into the final album, recordings over the course of years. You know, on any one song, there might be a performance that I took in 2012 up against one I took in, oh God, only knows, maybe 2019. So Everyone was much less finishing individual songs as it was slowly condensing and refining this whole piece. But I could take you through the process of what it's like to compose in that way and sort of how one piece starts and or how the whole thing starts and finishes, if you like.
Yeah, so I'm so curious about your relationship to wilderness recording and how this works in terms of writing pieces and then playing them back into a space, because I think this is quite an unusual way of working. And so I'd love to hear more about that, how you've developed that approach and why it's meaningful for you. I'm more familiar with artists who go out and take field recordings of spaces and then integrate those recordings into their work. And yours, I understand that you do some of that, but it seems like it's almost a reversed version of that. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. It's kind of like music theory, you know, like a person many centuries ago has created a bunch of things intuitively, or there's some degree of experimentation that yields better results for better pieces, and we try to find patterns in that. So by and large, this is like a deeply intuitive thing, but to sort of intellectualize the whole thing, I think it's because I'm not actually, I always use the analogy of like a sports journalist or something. Like, yes, they use words to communicate their thing, but they're not capital W words people, you know? They're not sitting there in love with the craft of words and only that. They're sports people, and that's how they interface with sports. And I like hiking, and I'm a bad rock climber, and I'm like, you know, live pretty an outdoor life, but how I interface with my subject is through music, and the subject that I've always had like a deep love and fascination with has been ecology and biology and the natural world, and specifically where I'm from, which is the Rockies. So it's really just a way of communing with that. And I think the idea behind playing things back and re-recording, and I'm always very careful to say, like, I understand the irony of playing back human-made noise into the forest and re-recording it. I mean, there's some hypocrisy there for sure. And I've, you know, every time I do it, I consult acoustic ecologists and parks people and stuff like that.
Why do you feel that there's a hypocrisy to it?
Oh, just because I work deeply. I work for a nonprofit called Quiet Parks a lot. And I started working for Quiet Parks because I couldn't find quiet space to record in. And Quiet Parks aims to conserve areas of natural quiet, much like a dark sky reserve does. And you know, there's a philosophical question of like, well, what's the difference between mechanical noise like a chainsaw or mechanical noise like speakers? And truthfully, there isn't one if you're an owl that's trying to hunt. But yeah, I think for me, the idea of playing it back into nature, there's sort of this romantic or classical way of making eco-critical work, which is very much the psychologist behind the glass wall approach to me, where there's sort of like a, you take out your easel and you sit and you paint the landscape and that's it. And the conversation is very one-sided and it's very analytical and a little bit, I don't know, there's something a little dark and scary about that to me. Whereas having sort of this loop of influence in the forest, I come away knowing more about the place. If I take this approach, I learn what times of day work best, when animals are alerting other animals that I'm around. I have to keep mindful of predator corridors and things like this. And the music, the way it reverberates around that space informs the composition. And then I go back and that informed composition gets played out again, but it's slightly different. And like there's this conversation that happens with a space that leads to a deeper knowing of that space that I think just taking field record, and I love taking field recordings, but I think there's just a lack of sort of conversation when that happens. It is very much like taking out the easel and painting and leaving. And I don't know. There seems to be more of a cyclical thing that happens when you play back recordings outside.
I'm very interested in your work because you have a deep love of science and you interact in many ways with, I think, folks in the world who are more coming from scientific backgrounds. Mm-hmm. For example, your love of paleontology and the dark sky and the quiet parks interest. But you're, of course, coming at these spaces from an aesthetic angle. And I'm wondering if you feel you have a responsibility to the places that you're collaborating with as an artist. And if so, what does that responsibility look like for you?
Yeah, I think I love research. I mean, my dad's a researcher. I love research, and I love there's so many amazing artistic things that can be done with the offcuts of the scientific process. But
that's a great term.
Thank you. which implies kind of science is butchery, which is funny too. I think
salty. It's
deeply salty. For the audience, I want it to be clear that Rebecca laughs very silently, and so there is laughter on her end. It's just you can't see it. it's a good radio laugh. I find music that, how do I put it? I don't know. Music that tries to be science fails at being both. Just like I think art that aims to be direct action fails at being both as well. And it's important to me. I'm so much a product person. You know, like I have all these interests that get me up and get me working. But at the end of the day, I really would love if the work was incredibly emotionally affecting with zero knowledge of any of that. You know, the goal for me is to try to find these emotional nuggets within all this stuff that interests me and display that in a way that is, you know, that somebody can enjoy with their whole body, you know, mind and heart, if I'm going to get corny about it. And I think so much in my tradition, or at least like adjacent music, there's this shying away from emotionally affecting work. And I've sort of, maybe as a contrarian, gone the other way and tried to make work that is incredibly almost uncomfortably emotionally affecting, you know, whether I'm successful or not. That is the aim. Like, I'm not trying to have this like John Cage thing where it's like, let's think of this sound for its own sake kind of vibe. I grew up listening to punk and metal, you know, that's what I want. And I think for me, the responsibility, if there is any, is more so just to I work with so much documentation of these spaces, literally. But I think emotional documentation of what it's like to be a person in these places at this time, when maybe these people and these places aren't going to be around forever. Well, it's not even a maybe, that's an inevitability. That's sort of the aim. Like I just want to have some kind of archive of what it felt like in these places. And I guess that is what draws me to the Rockies, is that they are emotionally overstimulating, and if that's what I want in music, I mean, maybe that's part of why I work in the Rockies so much. So that's a very long answer for you, but there you go.
Can you talk a bit about your title, Every When, and what that means for you?
Yes, the titling of all this stuff was a enormously long process, as was the album art. It's just like the scope of this thing damn near killed me, but the Every When came from my project with the artistic love of my life and dear friend Brad Nessick, who's this incredible artist. And we have a two-person studio called Studio Every When. And I mean, there's not a hell of a lot special about the word Every When. It's like everywhere, but in the timed domain. And I think often with my records, since naming and press photos of all things are like the last thing to happen, they sometimes more often reflect where I'm going than what the last record was so much about. So I've been interested in sort of collapsing the sort of ecological history of the Rockies into one time. that happens all at the same time. And our studio certainly deals with sort of this time dilation of a certain of certain natural places. So it just felt right, goddammit, to name this record that, also at the end of the day.
I find it, part of why I find that title compelling is that I'm very interested in, on a massive scale, the nature of time, the malleable, sticky taffy nature of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as musicians and audio workers, there's inherently an interest in that, but particularly when considering ecology and place, it can be easy, at least for me, to think of those places as static, but they're also a series of moments, which could be considered a series of discrete moments or a continuous sense of movement and change. So I love this title because it immediately draws me, it draws my ears and my mind to the idea of a place as time and change, as opposed to place as a static object, which I think looking at the Rockies in particular, they feel so eternal, but they're not. They're constantly in flux.
Oh my God, it's such a good point. I mean, you and I have talked about thin places before, which establishes a relationship beyond this interview, which audiences love. You and I have previously talked about thin places and how the Rockies are a thin place, and a thin place is sort of an Irish concept of a place where the membrane between what is old and what is new is thin, which is an amazing visual metaphor. The Rockies, like I had this hangout with Ben Gadd, who is, as I'm sure you're well aware, as a Rockies person yourself, like this, he is the most knowledgeable man about the Southern Canadian Rockies. Actually, no, like all of them. And he's trained as a geologist. And we were just talking about how unbelievable it is that, and I think this is part of my love for the Rockies, everything you see was once alive, or is alive, whether it's the actual living stuff all around you or the mountains. You know, the mountains are made of the limestone formed in the Bearspaw Sea however many hundreds of millions of years ago, and they all are from sort of the death of zillions of phytoplankton contributing to little calcified granules that make up lime, right? I'm butchering that, but that's kind of the deal, is that the mountains wouldn't be there had millions and millions of years of living things not died and formed them. And that's different than granite, and that's different than where I am now in the mountains that I'm here now. Like the Rockies are, all you see is the result of life, and there's no, I think that's so amazing. And the compounding effect of this tiny little microscopic snow of dying phytoplankton compounded by geological time has formed Rundle Mountain, has formed like Bourgeau, you know, it's unbelievable. And I think that's part of the reason why the place feels so thin, and why the record is named Everywhen, or there's a track called Place So Thin on the record.
Thank you.
So while we're on the topic of time, you mentioned earlier that you've been very into Jurassic
Fuck
Park.
Yeah, I have.
Lately. So what angle would you like to move into this next concept?
So Jurassic Park is the last Jurassic Park that will ever exist is premiering on the day that everyone comes out serendipitously, and is an incredible metaphor for like the sea change of what's about to happen. And for the record, like the new ones are all, you know, I mean, actually everything except the original is like questionable in quality, but unquestionably fun. So I'm not saying I'm a huge Jurassic Park nerd in the same way that people might, you know, get really into the lore of, you know, other big entertainment franchises. But
Of Goldblum. The lore of Goldblum.
He is ceaseless.
So hot.
He's so hot. He's so, like... Oh my God. Yeah, we could have like a little, would you ever consider doing like a hotties offshoot of this podcast, and we could talk about Goldblum only? There's a silent laugh happening for the audience now. It's not just me suggesting this and Rebecca staring blankly like that was inappropriate. Yeah, Goldblum's amazing. Goldblum is also, his performance of Ian Malcolm is like maybe the greatest casting that's ever existed. No, I'm less, you know, I'm very into Jurassic Park because it's fun and reminds me of my childhood. But more than that, for my whole life, I've been kind of into paleontology and sort of paleoecology because of this deep time.
What is paleoecology?
It's sort of the same thing. I think it's trying to, for any paleontologist listening to this, is going to be hilarious for you, but paleoecology, from my understanding, is not only is a subset of paleontology where you're trying to surmise greater ecological relationships between animals and trying to figure out what ecology was happening there and not just individual biomechanics or like recreating this one animal. You're trying to figure out sort of the relationships throughout the ecosystem, which is interesting for me as a field recordist. And so I've like been obsessed with this stuff, and I volunteer at the U of A fossil lab, and I'm like cleaning fossils sometimes, and it's just been a great love for me. And recently, we've gone into this renaissance of paleo art, and paleo art is the people who recreate artistically extinct animals, not just dinosaurs, but you know, all extinct animals. And there's like been these like two major shifts in the mentality of how paleo art thinks about how it does this. And in the last 5-10 years, there's been this massive shift in the scene brought on by new technology and like this seminal work called All Yesterdays. And even if you weren't into this stuff, it's wild to see a large subset of the arts just totally having a giant sort of lineup change and shift of mentality. And it's very exciting. And I've been a little bit swept up in it because I've been asked to work on a few projects where we're trying to figure out ancient soundscapes of what may have occurred. And there's so many holes in what that research offers that like the only conceivable way to fill them is artistically. And that's where we come in. So, yeah, I have to stop myself because I'm just so, so obsessed with this. If I can say so, I think it might actually be a true obsession for me, which is fun.
And what do you see as that shift? You said that there's been a sea change in a way of thinking about a certain area of art making. And I don't know very much about that at all. So I'm wondering if you can describe what you perceive that sea change as being.
Yeah, certainly. So back in the day, there were some exceptions to this rule. Like, there's some certain artists, and you've probably seen their work, that are exceptions. But up until, I want to say, the late 60s, again, apologies to paleontologists listening, there was sort of this dominant view of dinosaurs, which was reflected artistically, that they were slow and stupid and just kind of ginormous and in the way and sagging and not doing anything. And there was sort of one paper and one artist who sort of changed that. I think it was with Dromaeosaurus, and there's this famous photo of this dinosaur in pursuit, and sort of like red in tooth and claw and muscular and athletic and doing stuff. And that was sort of the dinosaur renaissance. And that sort of, it had another one in the 90s with Jurassic Park and Michael Crichton writing Jurassic Park. And I mean, there was interest in that anyway, beyond Jurassic Park. But this was the renaissance, and this was like, oh my God, dinosaurs aren't these slow, sort of pea brain things. They can be athletic and intelligent and muscular and fast. And we saw every depiction of dinosaurs as these like bodybuilder looking things, doing stuff and jumping over stuff and attacking things and like constantly hunting. And recently there has been a push to say, one, almost 0% of an animal's life, even large predators, is hunting. It's such a small percentage of their time. Why don't we have more incidental depictions of them? You know, I think this also brought on a little bit by social media, where we have a lot of incidental photos, and we come to expect sort of a portrait layout shot of something that's just like not doing anything, with like zero framing in mind. That sort of mentality of like, oh, I just happened upon this thing, has permeated a bit of animals sleeping or like cleaning themselves and not necessarily active. And also more than one species interacting together. And there's sort of this, a lot of eco-critical art has kind of gone through these growing pains, sound being a shining example of that, of like focusing on an individual and then focusing on groups and then finally focusing on the greater ecology. But the dominant thing about this All Yesterday's book that came out that sort of sparked this new thing happening is that it really cares about soft tissue. And these shrink-wrapped dinosaurs, these shrink-wrapped dinosaurs that are very muscular and bodybuildy, are somewhat anatomically inaccurate and also just like not correct. So the one example is, some of these artists have taken living animal skeletons and recreated them the way that we would recreate dinosaurs. And they have done that with a hippo. And if you've ever seen a hippo skull, like, you can imagine it just having these teeth that are hanging out with no lips like a vampire, and like shrink wrap skin to its skull to make it look very scary and angular. But in reality, most of a hippo is soft tissue. And although they're extremely dangerous, there's so much fat and tissue covering everything, because that's how the animal has to live given its environment. And we don't give prehistoric animals this treatment because this stuff doesn't fossilize. So there's a lot of intelligent and speculative artistry, because it's more art than science at that point, trying to find living examples of animals in similar ecological niches to be like, all right, you know, right now, for example, the most contemporary view of Tyrannosaurus, like, it has lips. It's not baring its teeth to dry out and to be exposed. You know, why would it? That's like, if it's so, it makes no sense. It's a dangerous thing to expose. You know, that's their valuable assets. So all to say, there's been this huge push. I'm rambling, you're gonna have to cut a lot of this, but I think also one thing that I would maybe pin my sort of, I don't know, throw my hat in the ring about, is if we're having this big change, maybe also like art that aims to depict deep time and ecosystems in deep time doesn't have to be so visio-centric either. Like, maybe we can start thinking about audio too. So that's how I'm weaseling my way into this thing that I feel is exciting, and I will stop myself there.
So you've mentioned the term deep time, mm-hmm. and this is also a term that I've come across quite a bit over the last few years, mostly through artists who have ecological practices of some sort. So the big one for me is the poet and multidisciplinary artist Angela Rawlings, who works quite a bit with something called geopoetics. We're actually having her on the podcast in a few weeks. And she talks about deep time, looking at shorelines, deep time of shorelines. And then I've also been hearing a lot about deep time in kind of the world of social practice. Philosophers and activists who are talking a lot about the idea of the long view. How will our actions not only impact our current earthscape, but multiple generations? And rather than being so anxious about feeling like you don't have an impact, thinking about what's the long view behind and what's the long view forwards. But that's still very much, when I've heard it used in social practice, it's really thinking about generational activism, like where we are now at, for example, with Black Lives Matter, is a result of activism done by Black train porters in the early 20th century. And we don't really see their work until the last couple of years, which I find fascinating. So I'm really interested then in, it's clear to me that you care a lot about our non-human world, as well as our relationships as humans to our non-human world, and finding ways to live more ethically, and conserve and protect certain ways of life, and start valuing certain ways of life that are maybe outside of humanity. And I'm curious if you have intellectualized or thought at all about where deep time fits into that for you and your own practice.
Oh man, amazing. I mean, incredibly, this is one of the first times, and this is like such a specific view of time, because, you know, there's this, it feels like there's also a lot of talk about time being viewed as cyclical versus linear, and like a lot of people in this vibe are very into that right now. But it is one of the, I've not thought about deep time so much moving forward. The implication, and I think the original term comes from geological time of the past. Yeah, it is interesting to think about where actions have got us to, and now where the seeds of that have been sown thousands of years ago, decades ago, millions of years ago. I mean, there's this incredible graph, and I don't want to butcher it too much, but it, you know, the correlation versus causation could be a little bit of a factor here, but it's about what states vote for who. And there's this, I forget which inland sea it was, but there was this giant inland sea. And I forget which geological time period it was, so this isn't so useful. But essentially, there was a huge deposit of dead everything along the shoreline of this huge sea that sort of cuts through this huge belt of the US. And that turned into a certain type of rock, which turned into a certain type of soil, which made the soil very fertile, which meant that plantations happened along that belt, which meant that, like, there was, you know, slavery in that place, in those places, and that turned into a certain population, which turned into a certain voting population. And there is the theory and the thesis of that whole thing is basically the shore of an ancient sea millions of years ago that's gone has now contributed to sort of what counties are blue and which counties are red in this particular part of the US. And there's a direct correlation to sort of the shoreline that once was because of this unfolding amount of events. It's interesting.
Whoa.
Yeah. Whoa. dang. I get the sort of goosebumps more, less about being like, and that's why we're where we are today. You know, that, I mean, you know, the past is a foreign country kind of vibe for me is more the appeal. I find it incredible when we somehow are able to, you know, reach our hand into the deep past and pull out some shred of knowledge that allows us to kind of relate to a time that seems unrelatable. You know, whether we find certain fossilized structures and feathers that give us a clue as to the coloration of something, and we're like, oh my God, we figured out potentially the color of certain dinosaurs. Like that, we never thought we'd do it. It was always something that we were blinded to. There's something incredible about trying to, it's sort of that colorized photo effect, you know, where you are more able to relate to people of the past. I find it incredible to work with a deep time as a subject when you're able to sort of scrape off the patina of time and for an instant kind of relate to a time that's so foreign, you know, to the Mesozoic when days only lasted 23 hours because the earth was spinning faster and like, you know, like it's just, it's, there's something magical about that. I do also think like, it's funny when I talk about my interest in paleontology, because I think a lot of people are like, that's cute. Like that's a cool childhood vestige that you've brought over. Like my cousin's into Marvel movies. You guys should hang out. You know, like it's, I'm like, man, like so many people are so willing to admit, or at least talk about how interested in ecology and nature they are. But like that all comes from somewhere, and that's part of a longer timeline. And the species that you're so interested in, of Douglas fir or whatever is so much older, than pre-contact, or anything like that. I don't know how I would have a relationship with the current ecological landscape that I live in without understanding how it showed up throughout deep time. I don't know. Yeah.
So moving backwards to forwards.
Love it.
What are you, aside from Jurassic Park, what are you...
I love that. So you're into Jurassic Park then. After all that. So aside from Jurassic Park.
What are you most excited about these days? I know you've just finished a big project and that it's soon to be out in the world. And you mentioned you're starting work on your newest record, but I'm so curious about what's sparking your curiosity in kind of these in-between times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think by starting this next record, which I think is going to have a lot to do with deep, deep time, that's really exciting for me. I'm really excited by the idea of concatenative synthesis for all you nerds who are listening, which would basically allow me to have like this audio fossilization where I can replace one set of sounds with another, but it will keep the same form. So that's exciting to me.
Can you say that word again?
Concatenative synthesis.
And what is that?
Hard to define. There's different types. And it's unclear whether it's true synthesis or anything like that. But for me, what that looks like is I have a big folder of sounds that I like, but I might get somebody to improvise on an instrument that I don't want to use, but they're a cool improviser, or I might hum a melody, or I might just make a tune without thinking about the ingredients. And then I would be able to swap out all those ingredients for the folder of ingredients I do like, and all kinds of fun, random accidents might happen. Because I'm very picky about my ingredients, but I don't want that to get in the way of the writing process either. So that's really exciting to me. And then the other thing is I'm building a daxophone, which is this hilarious instrument, and a really cool instrument made out of, I sourced a bunch of wood from the Rockies to do it. And we can talk about the daxophone if you like and put everyone to sleep. But so sort of this weird melding of like being into the world of paleontology and having this interesting computery thing that appears to have some kind of metaphor to fossilization, but then also having this instrument that I want to play with that is directly the sound of this like secret uncovered sound of the wood from the place that I care about so much. These things are exciting to me.
You've been listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast made by me, Rebecca Bruton, and produced in partnership between Newworks Calgary and CJSW Campus and Community Radio. All of the musical excerpts included in this episode are borrowed from Jonathan Kochuk's 2022 album, Everywhen. You can find it out now on Paper Bag Records. This interview was recorded on stolen native land.